Iran's president urges Iraq to speed up the enforcement of a parliamentary ratification mandating the expulsion of U.S. forces from the Arab country. France extends weekend lockdown in its northern region while health officials step up a nationwide vaccination campaign to battle the spread of the coronavirus. Also in the headlines this hour, protesters in Paraguay clash with police in the capital Asuncion during a rally against the government's poor handling of the coronavirus crisis. Welcome to the World News. Iranian president has urged Iraqi officials to speed up the enforcement of a parliamentary ratification mandating that is the expulsion of U.S. forces from the Arab country. In a telephone conversation with the Iraqi Prime Minister, President Hassan Rouhani said the move will help establish peace and security across the region, including Iraq. He emphasized that America has always played a destructive role in the region. Iranian president also expressed opposition to foreign meddling in Iraqi affairs, which he regards as detrimental not only to Iraq but the entire region. He stressed Iraq's integrity and security remain a priority for Iran. In response, Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi thanked Iran for helping establish peace and stability in Iraq. He also underlined the need to expand all-out bilateral relations. Political commentator Michael Springman says the U.S. has invaded West Asia and refuses to go home.
Well, it's there because it wants to control the region. It wants to enforce its influence, not only in Iraq, but in other countries there. The Persian Gulf countries like the Gulf Cooperation Council, Saudi Arabia, and so forth. And it's there to threaten Iran. It's watching Iran from its bases in Iraq. And of course, the American government thinks they have a right to be there, and they claim that they're there to enforce order and restore peace and security. And if they left, everything would turn into chaos. Well, it's chaos now simply because the Americans invaded and occupied and flatly refused to go home. And I could see them making a show of removing a couple of hundred soldiers. Or a particular unit or something like this, but they're not going to say, okay, we're going to take every last American soldier and mercenary, which everyone seems to forget. They're basically former soldiers who act as soldiers, but without uniforms.
Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan has been able to secure the backing of the parliament after his government suffered a shock defeat in the recent Senate elections. 178 members voted in his favor, six more than the required number to remain as the country's prime minister. Kamran Yusuf has more.
A sigh of relief for the Pakistani Prime Minister. The country's National Assembly reposed trust in Prime Minister Imran Khan in a vote of confidence. Prime Minister Khan himself sought the vote of confidence from the National Assembly after the government-backed candidate lost to an opposition leader in a Senate election. The defeat of the country's finance minister had raised questions whether the government commanded majority of the parliament. After winning the vote of confidence, Prime Minister Khan made it clear that he would not give any relief to opposition leaders facing corruption cases.
Mr. Zardari has been proven corrupt. He is known as Mr. 10%. On the other hand, Nawaz Sharif, after plundering the national wealth, has fled abroad. I will not give them any amnesty, come what may.
While inside the parliament, members were congratulating the Prime Minister, outside, government and opposition members were clashing with each other. The ruling party workers attacked the senior opposition leaders when they were holding press conference. Opposition parties condemned the violence. But Prime Minister Khan's supporters were jubilant for his success.
These people have not come here on Prime Minister Imran Khan's call. He has not given any official call. These are people who came here spontaneously. We decided ourselves. It's a grassroots movement. We decided that we'll come here to show our support for Imran Khan.
While Khan's supporters defend his performance, opposition thinks the country's economic situation has deteriorated under the current government. Prime Minister Imran Khan may have won the vote of confidence from the parliament, but observers believe his trouble is far from over. Amid economic and other challenges, Major opposition parties are planning to march towards the capital later this month to seek his ouster. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Spanish protesters have clashed with police during a fresh rally over the jailing of Catalan singer Pablo Hasél. Protesters in Barcelona were met by lines of riot police and police vans. Hasél, who is known for his anti-establishment raps, was jailed last month for allegedly glorifying terrorism and insulting royalty. His nine-month sentences prompted debate over freedom of expression in Spain. Several people have been injured and dozens detained since demonstrations against the rapper's detention began in Barcelona and several other cities in February. Now, many countries across Europe have reported more COVID-19 infections and deaths. France has extended weekend lockdowns to the country's north. That puts more than 2 million people across the country under the weekend restrictions. COVID-19 has killed 88,300 people across that country. In Britain, officials registered over 6,000 new daily cases, raising the country's total tally to over 4.2 million. The UK also recorded 158 more deaths. In Italy, the health ministry has reported over 300 daily deaths and over 23,000 new infections. The country's total cases now stand at over 3 million and its fatalities at nearly 99,000. A protest has been held in the Swedish capital of Stockholm against coronavirus restrictions in that country. The demonstration was held in defiance of a ban on large gatherings. Police blocked a bridge in the center of the city and dispersed protesters. Six officers were injured in the ensuing clashes. Sweden has so far reported over 13,000 COVID-19 deaths last month. The government said it would cut opening hours for restaurants and cafes and tighten limits on the number of people allowed in shops. Protesters demonstrate against protracted coronavirus restrictions in Austria. Many of the protesters did not wear masks or observe social distancing as they marched through the capital, Vienna. Police said arrests were made for breaching public order laws and coronavirus restrictions. Demonstrators demanded the resignation of Chancellor Sebastian Kurz. Anti-lockdown protests are on the rise in Austria, where many are frustrated by the continuing restrictions. The government says the limitations could be eased in the coming weeks if infections decline. However, the number of new daily infections has been on the rise, with more than 2,500 cases reported on Saturday. Brazil imposes new COVID-19 restrictions in its most populous cities as the country suffers a new surge in the pandemic or of the pandemic. In São Paulo, a lockdown is in place while officials in Rio introduced new restrictions, including a nighttime curfew. Several businesses in that city have also been ordered to either close early or shut down altogether. This comes as coronavirus deaths in Brazil are nearing 263,000 out of some 10.9 million confirmed cases. The figure is the world's second highest death toll from the pandemic. Meanwhile, the U.S. remains the world's worst hit with nearly 29 million confirmed infection cases and more than 524,000 deaths. Still in that region, clashes have erupted in Paraguay between police and protesters, angry at the government's poor handling of the coronavirus crisis. Angry protesters looted shops and torched cars in the capital, Asunción. Police fired tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse the crowd. Nearly 20 demonstrators were injured in the violence. Earlier in the day, protesters rallied outside the Congress building, demanding President Mario Abdo Benitez resign over his handling of the pandemic. Meanwhile, in Argentina, clashes broke out in the city of Formosa, where protesters faced off with riot police over lockdown restrictions. Novel coronavirus has so far infected over 2 million people in Argentina and killed more than 52,000. The restrictions imposed to curb the spread of the virus have also battered the country's economy. Now, a body cam video has surfaced in the U.S. showing the violent arrest of an African-American woman holding her three-year-old baby in Rochester. Local officials have called for fundamental change in the city's police department. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed this issue.
And now welcome everyone to the news review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. And now police in the U.S. city of Rochester come under scrutiny after a body cam video shows violent arrests of an African-American woman holding her three-year-old daughter.
I did not do anything.
Hey, we're right in the parking lot here.
Would you stop backing up?
Hey, okay.
Put the kid down.
Hey, okay.
Put the kid down. Put George Blanket back down. Put George Blanket back. Stop. 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 Turn around. Stop. Relax. Turn over so I can cuff you.
And the city's police accountability board said it was disturbed by the video and Rochester Police Department needs to fundamentally change. The city council said the amount of force used coupled with emotional damage suffered by the child was disproportionate to the alleged crime. The incident took place on February 22nd and body cam footage of the incident was released this last Friday. The woman was accused of shoplifting. Police used pepper spray to subdue her and forced her to lie on the ground. The woman was ultimately charged with trespassing, and the arresting officer was placed on administrative leave pending an internal probe. And joining us now for this news review is Netfa Freeman, a senior member of Black Alliance for Peace, joining us from Washington, D.C., and Life Malcolm, a community organizer and commentator that is part of Tampa Bay, Florida. I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start there in Washington, D.C. with you, Ms. Netfa Freeman. Your thoughts on this? We continue to see disturbing images of encounters between law enforcement, usually white, and African-American people from the community. Your thoughts on this latest video?
Mm-hmm. Well, these are examples of the fact that this is a settler colony and that African people and indigenous people are colonized and that the police are an extension of the state, which is there to maintain settler colonialism. So under colonized people, under settler colonialism, many of our activities are criminalized. In fact, in this instance, the person didn't do anything, but they still even charged her with something. But the police in this instance, like others, one of the issues that we have to tackle, those of us who are subjected to this, is that this is a systemic issue and it's not about the individual behavior of police. In fact, that you hear that the review board had concerns about it happening, but these review boards and things like that, this is an issue of power for us, for people who are colonized. We have to shift power. We have to have campaigns that give power over public safety and different things to the people in the community instead of to capitalists overlooking property and protecting the status quo in that sense. But we have to shift the paradigm. So, that's what I'm seeing here is that these things will continue until we start talking about some real democratic, people's democratic participatory solutions that take the power over the police from those who are, and all the resources that are spent on police departments and everything, and put that power into the hands of the communities who are able to come together and democratically decide what public safety should look like, what a public safety force should look like, and actually other places to apply these resources than to people who are just trying to survive.
Thank you, Netfa. In Life, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Now, Life, we've seen so many protests in the last couple of years, hundreds of protests trying to address this very, very, very sensitive issue there in the States. We haven't seen really anything change. We see this kind of behavior continue to perpetuate in law enforcement. And then we heard Netfa, just to his point, he says we need to shift the paradigm. Tell us how you would do that. How would you shift the paradigm?
You're right. We've seen a lot of people get involved in action over the past couple of years. Certainly last year was a tremendous period of rebellion and resistance. The way to shift the paradigm, though, is to focus that energy to a point, to a goal, to an objective. All of those actions should have as a question, to what end? In other words, why are we protesting? Why are we out in the streets? Why are we, raising our voices against this colonial institution known as the police? And so once we answer that question, to what end, then the paradigm perhaps will shift if we come up with the correct answer. And the answer has to be in order to gain power and control over our own lives. The thing is, African people in this country, in the United States, as it's called, are colonized people. We are a colonized nation in this country. And our objective has to be to gain power and control over our lives. Every move we make, every protest, every demonstration, every rebellion, the stuff that they call looting and riots and whatever, are rebellions against the political power structure. But all of those rebellions must have as its objective and final goal to claim power and control over our own lives.
Thank you, gentlemen. Stay safe, both of you. Time has gotten the better of us. Netfa Freeman, senior member of Black Alliance for Peace, joining us from Washington, D.C. Mr. Life Malcolm, community organizer and commentator, joining us from Tampa Bay, Florida. That's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Welcome back. Iran's International Quran Competition is a major Quranic event, which is held every year in Iran before the holy month of Ramadan. This year, however, the Quranic event is held online due to the coronavirus pandemic. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Voices of Divinity. These ear-soothing voices narrate divine verses from the holy book of Quran. The recitations come as part of the 37th International Quran Competition based in Iran. 57 finalists from 26 countries are competing in the annual contest, which was held online this year due to the pandemic.
This year, the contestants send us recordings of their recitations. Those recitations then are broadcast live on the IRIB Quran channel, and the judgment is carried out by our selected jury members at the same time. This is a brand new style in holding the competition. All other similar Quranic events are canceled as a result of the pandemic.
411 participants from 67 countries took part in the primary stage of the competition. 122 contestants made it to the semi-final stage. Participants compete in three different fields of recitation, memorization, and interpretation.
Listening to the verses of the Quran through the beautiful voice of Quran reciters gives you better peace and spirituality. Such recitations permeate the depths of your heart and connect you to God. That is why the tradition of recitation is still extant today and has many followers.
There is a verse in the Holy Quran that says, "Verily, in the remembrance of God do hearts find rest." And the reading or reciting the divine verses of the Holy Book truly makes you remember your Creator and help you find peace.
The Endowment and Charity Affairs Organization, which organizes the Quranic event, says the motto of this year's edition is One Book, One Ummah. It says the ultimate goal of the event is to unite the Muslim community based on the teachings of the Holy Book of Quran.
Not all Muslims can recite the Holy Book of Quran as perfectly as contestants here do, but every Muslim family has the Holy Book in their houses to read it and ponder the messages embedded in its verses. Messages that Muslims here say boil down to this key instruction: follow the path of righteousness. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. the limelight.
The World Trade Organization, WTO, a global regulatory body that contains 164 members and observers, including the United States of America, has blocked a proposal put forth by India and South Africa to grant a waiver to patent protections that are preventing poorer countries from accessing COVID-19 vaccines, says Sam Knight, a reporter, in an article published under the heading, Biden's Trade Representative Nominee Backs Policies That Hinder Global Vaccine Distribution. Stay tuned for the details, please. Katherine Tai, President Joe Biden's nominee to serve as the next top U.S. trade negotiator, acknowledged during her confirmation hearing that trade policy over the past few decades benefited corporate interests at the expense of workers and the environment. But Tai declined to commit to making the U.S. Trade Representative's office more accountable to lawmakers and the public. Tai did not respond directly to questions about transparency asked by Democratic members of the Senate Finance Committee. Senator Bob Menendez pressed Tai to support legislation that he co-sponsored, which could create an inspector general serving as an official watchdog for the USTR. Senator Elizabeth Warren asked Tai about the possibility of the USTR releasing draft trade negotiations at least 2 months before Congress is asked to fast-track it so that lawmakers have the opportunity to propose amendments. Under current rules, which were signed into law in 2015 by then-President Barack Obama, Congress doesn't receive the text of trade deals until after relinquishing its treaty negotiating authority to the White House, the so-called fast-track process that Senator Warren referenced in her question. The law that established the current regime is set to expire on July 1st. In response to both lawmakers, Tai hailed the principles behind their inquiries, but did not directly comment on their either proposal. Warren was disappointed. I very much appreciate that you want to engage with the American people on this, but what I'm really looking for here is a hard commitment, Warren said, in the most contentious moment of the confirmation. To me, this is another place where the administration needs to take a hard line. Trade negotiations must be open and transparent to the public, she added. Nevertheless, left-leaning Democrats were pleased by her recognition of long-standing progressive critiques of trade liberalization, the practice of eliminating laws that hinder international commerce, even if those laws were crafted to bolster protections for workers, consumers, and ecosystems. For example, while Tai praised the motives behind the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, just like President Biden has done, she distanced herself from efforts to rejoin the agreement. The PPP was widely criticized by labor unions and environmental groups for undermining economic regulations and was opposed by both major presidential candidates during 2016 election. In 2017, then-President Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the TPP during his first days in office. A lot has changed in the world in past 5 or 6 years, and a lot has changed in our own awareness about some of the pitfalls of trade policies that we've pursued as we've pursued them over the most recent years, Tai remarked in response to a question urging the Biden administration to rejoin the PPP from Senator Steve Daines. Hi. Thai also noted more broadly that U.S. trade policy in recent decades has primarily served to make winners out of corporate executives and shareholders and losers out of everyone else. I think that for a very long time, our trade policies were based on an assumption that the more we traded with each other and more liberalized our trade became, the more peace and prosperity there would be, she said. I think what we see in the parlance of some of the economies who have been thinking about this, over time, the trends we see are a race to the bottom. With increased economic activity and trade activity, we aren't necessarily seeing that bring up standards with respect to workers and environmental protection, Thai added. She said, I think this prompts us to really have this reinform us, rethink of our strategic trade policies and figure out how trade policy can be conducted in a way that truly does lift all boats. Thai also touted recent efforts to reverse this trend in response to a question from Senator Sheldon Whitehouse about investor state dispute settlement panels. ISDS are courts established by free trade agreements in which only investors can file litigation against governments for erecting barriers to the trade. White House lamented the existence of such panels, which are part of most trade deals that the U.S. has signed, by noting how Philip Morris bullied Togo out of passing a law that would have added images to cigarette warning labels. The tobacco giant achieved this in 2013 in part by invoking the threat of ISDS action in trade agreements signed by a small West African nation. Additionally, however, Thai said she would defend corporate interest by looking into establishing new mechanisms to defend intellectual property, patent protections for various brands and products, including vital medicines. Intellectual property rights have gained new importance during the global COVID-19 pandemic. The World Trade Organization, WTO, a global regulatory body that contains 164 members and observers, including the United States of America, has blocked a proposal put forth by India and South Africa to grant a waiver to patent protections that are preventing poorer countries from accessing COVID-19 vaccines. The Trump administration led a very small group of WTO members in blocking this important public health initiative, explained Public Citizen Trade Expert Lori Wallach in a virtual press conference held recently. WTO rule changes are typically only approved by unanimous consent. Joining the U.S. in blocking patent waivers on COVID-19 vaccines were representatives of other wealthy countries, including Great Britain, the European Union, Norway, Switzerland, Japan, Canada, and Australia. Unfortunately, in the first two meetings of WTO committees since the Biden administration arrived, the U.S. position has not changed, Wallach noted. Ultimately, Thai was hailed by lawmakers on both sides of the aisle and looks set to sail through the confirmation process.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends, and let us start the day by contemplating upon an aphorism of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, the first infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Personality is to avoid doing a matter secretly if you feel embarrassed to do it openly.
you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This man changed the world.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and a particularly warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to the life and times of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul. And I'm your host on this program, Ijaz Hussain. I'm joined by Dr. Mahdi Turabi, academic and Islamic scholar. I wish to welcome him to the program on this occasion. Salam, sir.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Mahdi Turabi, we are going to discuss, as usual, some great quotes that Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, mentioned. And of course, they're deep, profound, and still have great implications even today. Because, of course, he understood the real nature of things. Very much like our masoom imams, if I can say. He gave us a taste of that. I'm just saying that, you know, delicately. Because I don't want people to confuse things by what I'm saying. But I'm saying that he gave us a taste of what our imams were like in a bygone era.
Exactly.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ma avalan tashakkur mikunim az hayat dawlat va millat Iran.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Firstly, I would like to thank the government officials and the Iranian nation who, during this period of war, despite being under intense pressure, powerfully and while preserving the grandeur of Islam, performed well until this obstacle in our way was surmounted. And today, we must talk about certain issues. One among them is that we must not consider the war to be over. We must think as if we are still at war, because our enemy, either our great enemies such as America and the Soviet Union, and others who are the fruits of their sins, such as Saddam and the like, are against Islam and have witnessed how Islam today has turned into a great power. For this reason, in return, they are ever devising
schemes. از این جهت اونها دائما مشغول نقشه کسی هستن و ما نباید از این مسئله غفلت کنیم.
We must not be negligent in this matter. Both the people and the armed forces must be prepared. As for those people who must serve in the front lines, they should pursue this matter and must not waver. Our enemy is one who operates under schemes. It is now possible that this issue is spread in Iran that, well, the issue is settled and what have you. They want to make people waver even though the issue is not settled. They are always after doing the things themselves, even if it is done at the hands of the nations and governments themselves. Because they are unable to do this in Iran, neither the nation nor the government is with them. For this, they take different approaches.
برای خودشون را انجام بدن ولو به دست ملت‌ها یا دولت‌ها در ایران چون نمیتونن این کار رو بکنن نه ملت با اونهاست نه دولت از این جهت یک راه‌های دیگری که دارن دنبال میکنن
For this reason, we must be awake. People must fill the front lines. We must consider ourselves to be at war. You clearly see that they do not care about anything. Today they declare war, tomorrow they make peace, the next day they declare war once again. For this reason, our armed forces and nation must be prepared.
He's talking about fundamental issues, deep human issues of justice, of recognizing your enemy, recognizing the nature of the oppression that we as the human race are suffering in this world in the 21st century, as we've discussed in other programs related to the wealth, the extreme wealth gap, and so many other issues. So, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, the floor is yours, sir. What did the Imam mean by saying that the war is over?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Basically, there's two things we need to discuss here. One is,
sure,
as you said, he understands who the enemy is.
Exactly.
And is not fooled by the enemy. No. Ever.
Ever.
And that happens only if you know the enemy properly. I mean, it's not, there's no other way.
Yes.
And what he talked about is that basically after the war, he said, you know, we are still at war. Because, you know, and just imagine that time, you know, we just went through the war.
Yeah, I know.
And my mom...
So many sacrifices.
Right.
So
and
much.
You know, and my mom says, you know what? We're still at war.
We're still at war. Exactly.
He says, I consider myself still
I mean,
at war.
That speech in which, you know, he referred to the fact that even when the ceasefire was accepted, you know, Imam referred to that as drinking a poisoned chalice. I mean, that was the metaphor that he used, that, you know, this was not the result that he was looking for.
Well, it's not, it's more than that. I mean, he's basically saying that don't think because...
Yeah, just because...
The you know, the military war that they were waging is over, that they stopped their war.
Yeah.
They're waging it with different means.
Means,
now.
Exactly, right. Exactly. So, well, whether we call it the soft war or whether we call it the economic war,
exactly.
It doesn't matter. Or the nuclear issue,
right.
It doesn't matter
so
what we
call it. So this is the point. And it all goes back to the issue of knowing who the enemy is. And again, all this stuff that we're saying, exactly what also the Supreme Leader is talking about, which is that, you know, when you show flexibility, when you have that heroic flexibility that he talks about, when you negotiate with Satan, and he says, great Satan.
Great Satan, yes.
He didn't even... He's not trying to, you know.
No, no. I mean, it was not.
You know, you remember. He's the Satan. You remember. It's the great Satan.
Great Satan. Yes.
Okay. You don't forget that.
No, I don't forget that because the thing was that's what we were talking about before as well. It's not about just characterizing somebody or demonizing your enemy. He's not in that business. He's saying that's it. He's the great Satan.
Right.
I'm pointing to him.
Right.
Look at him. Recognize him for what he is. And the wickedness that is going to come out of this Satan.
Exactly. So exactly. this is the point in all this.
And I think that resonates today anyway.
Right. Yeah. So that's why I'm saying that this is important to look at Imam, not simply as somebody, you know, he was always on guard. He always understood what was happening around him. He didn't let the smiles of the enemy, he didn't let the grimacing or the threats of the enemy, you know, get him confused about who the enemy really was. And this enemy, as he says, this enemy is an enemy whose fundamental animosity is with Islam.
Exactly.
It's and why Islam? Because we're not talking about Islam here as simply a historical matter.
No.
We're talking about Islam as the manifestation of divine truth.
Exactly.
Okay? They don't like Islam because Islam is the latest, the final revelation, the latest and the final manifestation of divine
will and
commands. And some of these commands will get in their way of them becoming wealthy and privileged and keeping their wealth and privilege and being above the law. Okay, this is the nature of the affair, and has always been the same.
Always been like this.
Okay, exactly. This is not something that because somehow we're living in a different period, things have fundamentally or essentially changed.
No.
This is what certain people who say modernity is, you know, has fundamentally changed things. No, nothing fundamentally
changed
because
anything.
Humans haven't fundamentally changed.
Sure.
I'm talking about the essence of humans.
Exactly.
Okay?
Wonderfully put. Because,
this is
a point.
So when humans are still the same, you can't say things have fundamentally changed.
Sure.
It's about nafs. It's about jihad al-akbar.
Mm-hmm.
It's about jihad al-nafs.
Sure.
It's about, that inner struggle. It's about trying to get to a higher level of consciousness and existence and understanding and ma'rifah.
Sure.
It's about getting close to Allah.
And the other thing is that...
Or God,
And the Imam is also pointing
out... So this is the way it's always been.
Exactly. And what I wanted to fundamentally say there was that the Imam, God bless his soul, was pointing out, not in terms of, demonizing or calling names, that this is the great Satan. He's saying there are Satans in power. This is a fundamental Quranic concept that because man can be higher than angel or less than animal.
Exactly.
And what he's pointing out there is that the wrong kind of people are in power.
Right. And he's saying that, don't think because, we were successful in repelling Saddam's armies and that, there's no more rockets being shot or there's no more, whatever, air raid sirens,
sure,
doesn't mean that the war is over.
Yeah.
The war has shifted to a new field.
Exactly.
And that new field is different things, whether it's cultural, whether it's economic, whether it's, putting pressure, psychological warfare. And that's why he says, I consider myself to be at war right now still. And because this is the thing, people get confused about the affairs that happen in their lives, thinking that something essentially or fundamentally changes, thinking that somehow the enemy has become a different person now, or the essence of the enemy has changed. If whenever you see, an enemy or a person or a movement or a society, standing in front of those truths which God has revealed in terms of being the order of things, where certain lines cannot be transgressed, then they're the enemy that way. It doesn't matter if they're smiling at you. It doesn't matter if they're not hurling rockets at you. They're still your enemy.
Exactly.
They're going to try to get to their goal in a different way.
Exactly.
And so, I think this is something we need to learn today. I think we kind of forget that sometimes.
Yes.
Maybe because people like us, we actually saw him and we experienced him. It's kind of seared in our minds, and we don't, alhamdulillah, this was a big blessing from Allah that we were able to see him in our own lives.
Yeah.
But people who haven't seen him, maybe the younger generation.
Yes.
This is why it was very correct what you were saying, that we got a taste of it. So when you get the taste of it, you can't go back after that.
Exactly.
You can't slack off. And unfortunately, we see people do that, even people who did see him.
Hmm.
Even people who were his companions.
Hmm.
Just the way you saw people who were, with the Prophet or with Imam Ali alayhi salam, with the Prophet peace be upon him, that they didn't understand.
They didn't understand.
And yet people who never saw those two with their own eyes, they completely understand.
They completely understand, yes. This is
okay.
A great irony as well.
So, you have to look at this man. I'm talking about Imam Khomeini.
Mm.
And it's an amazing thing because here is a man and he's telling you exactly the way things are, as you said, understanding the nature of things.
Mm.
And at the moments where people would usually be dominated by their emotions or
perhaps not want to hear the truth.
Right. Or want to indulge their,
fantasies about whatever.
Right. Or let's just say it in a positive way, who would want to give themselves, a few moments of relief and delusion and illusion and fantasy in terms of how things should be, the war has ended. Let's celebrate.
The war is not ended.
Right? And here he is, he's saying, the war is not ended.
Because, of course, the war isn't over because, there is an imam still waiting in the wing to appear again.
Exactly.
So how can we let off any steam, put it that way? I mean, we can have a little bit of R&R, just to sort of recharge our batteries. But the fundamental thing is that we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that what is this all aiming for?
Exactly.
Exactly. And this is the thing we want to make, as we said, the mandate the divine mandate from the Holy Quran a reality. And it can't become a reality unless we don't do our bit. And that's the whole point, isn't it? Because this is what he's pointing out, that look, you know, this world is very, very ugly. There are people in power, corrupt politicians, and we know them. We don't even vote now, you know, even in Scotland we don't vote. And we don't vote because we know what they are. We've seen their nature now. We know they even the media, even the corporate media comes out with liar or economical with the truth. And, you know, expenses scandals and right. stuff like this. I don't need to go through all that. The point is that whether we are talking about in Europe or in the U.S., it doesn't matter. The Imam was essentially pointing out to us that, look, this is just the beginning.
Right.
We've started on a path here where we are trying to make the program of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, the program that was given for the perfection of mankind a reality. How is this reality going to manifest itself in the light of the fact that we are surrounded by the great Satan? How do you deal with this? Thank you, Doctor.
Exactly. So, you know, this is why people like Imam are important, because they guide us and they make us really understand, because you were talking about Quranic understanding. This is what the Quran is telling us. This is what God has revealed through the Quran, is that, you know, your life is struggle.
Your life is struggle, exactly.
And struggle in the good sense, where you're doing, where you're trying to constantly get to the next level and strive for. And of course, you know, one day it is over, but, you know, not in this world.
Not in this world, right? Exactly. Thank you. Thank you for that.
And, you know, just so that we understand this correctly, because we have to say this completely, this is where you understand what Imam Ali alayhi salam means when he says that this world is the
harvest is the
field in which you sow for the next world.
Exactly.
So it's not like you're just randomly struggling and Allah is just throwing you a little, you know, curveballs where you don't know what to do. It's basically you're building your akhira.
Okay. Exactly.
So really the goal is to get to the point where you can see when you're doing something or when you're, you know, refraining from something, which you're not supposed to do, where you can actually see the akhira of it, right? Like, why don't we get into namaz or into the prayer the way some urafa do? Why are they so into it and we're not?
Quite.
Because they see the reality of their
this is where they're
praying for an hour and you're like, well, what's going on? He's like, well, you don't know where I am right now.
Quite.
Okay. Or, you know, there's that famous riwayat, I mean, you're a bigger expert on riwayat, where, you know, it's in heaven or it's in the next world or, you know, and, or it's with Allah, and they ask Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, like, would you go back? He says, you know,
he says
the only only reason I would go back is so that I would, you know, fast in the summer and do wudu in the winter's night.
That's right.
Which, you know, these are the hard.
I'm trying to remember the source now, but right?
I'm just simply pointing out. This is just an illustration of what we're talking about. I can't remember the exact reference to it, but basically, it's like, okay, some of the hardest in terms of just worship. Some of the hardest worships are, you know, fasting during the summer, where you have, you know,
very
15,
long
16 days,
and also high temperatures.
Right. And then also the other thing, which is a little unpleasant sometimes, is, you know, and remember, he's referring to a time where we didn't have, you know, indoor plumbing and hot water at a, you know, plumbing coming out of the tap. You have to go out to the well and pump the water and break the ice,
yes.
And, you know, do your wudu.
Wudu, yeah.
So here he is, he's saying, you know, those are the two things which were the best things in this world. Because when he gets there, he realizes, wow, those are the things that built my akhira.
Those were the things that built my akhira.
So we're looking at this war, because people are saying, well, wow, what is this thing Imam is talking about? Always war and struggle, and why can't we just chill out, and why can't we just relax? And
love everybody.
And the point is, well, if you understand it, what you're doing, and the the reality of it, and you go, well, how can I understand it? I mean, again, you know, I'm trying to play devil's advocate here. Yeah. Well, it has to do with self-purification. I mean, it has to do with really looking at your, making an inventory or making an audit, whatever you want to call it, of your life, your everyday life, you know, what you do throughout the day.
I mean, this is the thing.
How where is your money coming from? How is it really halal? I mean, is it really
exactly?
Are there problems there?
I was going to.
You know, it's how do you treat your family? How do you treat your wife? How do you treat your children? How do you treat your mother?
Wonderful.
How do you treat your father? How do you treat your, you know, the brothers and sisters around you who are, whether they are your biological brothers or sister or whether
your spiritual brothers
and, you know,
and sisters.
You've got all these rivayat about, you know, the haq that one moment has
over another,
and you know, we like totally pass by it. Like, we're like, oh yeah, you have haq a moment. You're like, dude, it's
what,
not that simple.
I mean, this is the thing that the imam is talking about, because these are all this is the difficulty of this struggle. I mean, to comprehensively live God's commandment is no joke.
Exactly.
It's not a joke. This is what I fear. You know, there's a wonderful thing I heard from one ulama, and I don't mean to digress, but
right.
We're on the same thing here. That really, you know, because of our shortcomings, he says, live between Alhamdulillah and Astaghfirullah. Live between those two.
Right.
Like this, right?
That's very good.
Wonderful. I mean, that's the way I feel. God, I am inadequate. I am in Farsi, as they say, and the only one Farsi word that I've learned, zisht. I understand that now. I got it.
Right.
And I want to get out of that level, but I don't know how. And the only thing is that examples like this imam, who says that you should have this framework, this mentality, that you're constantly at war with everything in this world. Not because you hate it, no. But
no,
it's because essentially...
It's not even, I don't even know if we can use the word war.
I know. It's,
okay.
It's struggle.
It's jihad.
Jihad.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know how you
can, right,
you can't,
there's
it in English.
Let's just call it jihad.
Let's call it jihad.
In English. Call it Jihad Akbar.
Let's call it Jihad Akbar. Yes, because that's the one. That's the one. Jihad Akbar. The greater one. That was the one that the Prophet spoke about. Right.
So they come back. They come back from the war.
War, yeah.
And they're like, oh, okay, you did Jihad Akbar. Now you have to do Jihad
Akbar. Jihad Akbar. The purification.
So this is what Imam is telling them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they just come back from the war.
Mm-hmm.
This is what Imam Khomeini is telling them.
Exactly.
Right?
And Imam Khomeini is also pointing out, you know, and he does that in his will as well. He doesn't quote these hadiths for the sake of the fact that, oh, this is just traditional. You know, we've been seeing it for the last 1,400 years.
Right.
He's quoting that particular hadith because it has a profound effect on the way you're going to be guided to your goal. And that is essentially when he says, embark on the ship of Noah, on the ship of Noah, the salvation of Noah. The ship of salvation of Prophet Noah, peace be upon him, because the Ahlul Bayt are like this, right? And if you don't do that, what's going to happen to you? You're going to get confused. You're going to get confused about your enemy. You're going to get confused about your economy. You're going to get confused about your mother and father. You're going to get confused about a whole range of things, which when you die, as Imam Ali alayhi salam says, these people are sleeping.
When
they die, they
awake. Up.
And when they awake, then they realize, oh.
Exactly. And there's worse. The worst than that is when you go, when the day of judgment comes.
Yes.
That's when there's, that's it. It's the full reality. Because even when you die, you're going to barzakh. There's still some filters, some hijab.
Some connection here and
there's
there, yeah.
still some level where Allah is like, you know, sparing you the pain of understanding the reality of what you did.
Of what you did.
You're still given a little opportunity to, you know, spruce up things. But then, you know, that's why it's called Yawm al-Hadid.
Yawm al-Hadid,
you know, it's sharpness, it's steel, it's... You suddenly realize, oh my God, this is what's happening. So all this we're saying in order to understand when a person like Imam Khomeini, again, not a masoom.
No, not a masoom.
Like me and you.
No.
In the sense
this is the wonderful thing about it.
Is saying, look,
yeah.
you know, you're at war.
Mm-hmm.
Don't think any differently.
Yep.
The enemy is still that enemy.
Mm-hmm.
They're still against God and they're still against God's truth.
Mm-hmm.
and God's commands. And this is not something you should be upset about. I really, I'm worried. I think we have this thing among a lot of us, and I'm including myself. I'm not trying to
say
I'm better than anyone. No. I'm worse than anyone in all this.
Sure.
Where we kind of want to be Muslim, but we don't want to really. We also want to have that kind of kafir way of living,
doing things.
You know.
Yeah, I like that.
Like that attitude. Like sure. You know, we're like. It's like lifestyle Muslim.
Muslim.
And I don't mean lifestyle in the way, that people talk about it today or the Supreme Leader has talked about it in terms of Islamic lifestyle. It's like, okay, you know, we'll do everything and live exactly like kafirs. We'll just do it with a beard.
Do it with a beard, yes.
You know, we'll do it with hijab.
We'll do it with a hijab,
You know, we'll you know, people after lunch, you know, they'll go and have a smoke. We'll go have our prayer.
Yeah.
You know, at work.
At work.
Otherwise, hey, we're just like you. Right? And I think that's good. When you look at a person like Imam...
Having lived in the West, that resonates.
You know, when you look at a person like Imam and you're thinking, no, that's not the way it works.
No, that's not the way
it works. And I'll give you another example, which is worse than this example which we were talking about, or this Western kind of... You look at certain people who are officials, politicians, who are running the affairs of a nation, and in this case we're talking about the Islamic Republic...
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
And what they end up doing is they end up running the nation and being an official and being a politician exactly the same way as non-Muslims would be.
Yes.
With a beard.
With a beard, yes. Right? Yes. That's the qualification.
With a hijab.
With the hijab.
With like, you know, with chador.
Yeah, with double chadors.
Right. Yeah. With like, you know, Islamic dress.
Yes.
And so, you know,
you go
instead of like going out for the cigarette break with the interns or with like, you know, the junior staff.
Yes. You have the adhan.
You do the adhan and you do the prayer room.
Prayer, yes.
Do you understand?
I've got you.
So, again, I'm saying all this. And then you look at Imam and you're like, Imam wasn't like that. He wasn't a leader like.
No.
He wasn't because, you know, he was obviously the leader of a revolution. He was the leader of a nation. He was the commander of a war, right? He wasn't some big. He wasn't like Gandhi, you know, the Shia version of Gandhi.
You know what I mean?
Astaghfirullah, right?
So he was
just something different.
He was. Because he was living Quran. Right. That's what made him different.
Exactly. So he led. Mm. He led a nation. He led a revolution. Mm. He commanded a war. Mm. Quranically.
I'd like to point out something. You understand
what I'm saying?
No, I'm just wanting to point out something.
So here you have him, the commander of an army, and any other leader who had just conducted 8-year war successfully.
Sorry.
When the people are coming back, and when the troops are coming back, and when everybody's, you know, would anybody else ever would have said, "Hey, the war is continuing"?
Yeah, the war is still on. I got news for you.
You know, thanks for all this. I got news for you. We're still at war. Right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, we've talked about these examples. Or, you know, Khorramshahr is liberated.
Right. And he said God liberated.
And instead of being like, you know...
Yeah, yeah. Well,
you know, good on boys, you know, like...
Yeah. We're almost there.
You know, he's like, God liberated.
God liberated.
He flies into Tehran. Uh-huh. It's like, you know...